Welcome to the Joseph Campbell Audio Collection. This talk is called Thresholds of Mythology. It is the first selection in the series entitled Inward Journey, East and West. And now, Joseph Campbell.
In the first place, then, let me just say that mythology, in general, serves four functions. The first and basic function might be said to be that of reconciling consciousness to existence, to life. When you realize that the life was present on this planet for literally millions and hundreds of millions of years before consciousness emerged and the eye and mind beheld what is here, and when you think of an infant before its consciousness comes to flower, already doing the major job of its life, namely producing a body out of a couple of little cells, bringing forth this miracle, with all of the organs already functioning, none of these organs having asked consciousness what it was functioning for, it being the job of consciousness rather to find out what the body is all about, you realize that there's rather a split here between the monstrous thing that life is. Just consider its basic character. It consists of living by eating other lives. Its main character is monstrous. And when consciousness becomes aware of this, there is this sense of terrific awe and horror, but also fascination and recognition, because that is what we are. Now, the mythologies in general take two attitudes toward this. One is that of affirmation, that is to say, reconciling consciousness to the nature of existence. And the other attitude I call the great reversal, which is that of turning all the positives into negatives and rejecting it, saying, this is something that should not have been. Let us pull out. Remember Schopenhauer's statement, life is something that should not have been. The Buddha's saying, all life is a fire. There's the fire of passion, the fire of fear, the fire of this, that, and the other aspect of life. Quench that fire. Nirvana is the quenching of the fire. So we have, in general, two basic attitudes that the myths are going to illustrate. One, that of horrendous affirmation, and the other, that of no less horrendous withdrawal. Now, it's one of the characteristics of our contemporary world that we don't face these two alternatives, but try to say, well, I will affirm life. I don't like people who don't. But I'll affirm it on condition that it reforms and makes itself go the way I and my mind and my friends feel it ought to go. Of course, there can be a softening down of the horror of life. We don't go butchering our way through, unless we have to face it out in a war. But the basic character of life cannot be changed. That's all there is to it. And the final attitude must be either of affirmation of life as it is, or rejection of it. These, in general, are the two positions. The second function of a mythology and religion is to present a single cosmological image, an image of the cosmos, an image of the universe, of the world, and of life within it, which will render the sense of this mystery that we ourselves are, and will communicate and maintain the fascination and awe, and in the positive religions, a sense of gratitude for all this in the individual. First function is to reconcile consciousness to existence or to reject existence. The second function is to present an image of the universe through which the sensed meaning or power or nature of life will be rendered. The third function is to validate and maintain a certain given moral order. And it's here that the mythologies differ greatly from one place to another. And the fourth and final function is to harmonize and deepen the psyche, the psychological structure and experience of the individual. We may call these first the truly mystical aspect, second the physical or scientific or cosmological, the third the sociological, and the fourth and final the psychological functions of myths. In the great living traditions, all of these functions were served simultaneously and harmoniously. However, we now have realized that the order of laws that governs the stars and the planets and the spaces of the universe is not to be taken as a model for the government of society, nor are the laws that are prudent for a social organization necessarily the best and deepest for the psyche. The modern secular state does not pretend to divine authorization. Its laws are simply conventional, whereas the older societies pretended, and some of them actually supposed, that their laws were divinely given somehow and were part and parcel of the universe. When we look at the old mythologies, the old religions, the laws by which the society is governed are regarded in general as being as inevitable, as apodictically given so that you can't get away from them, as the laws of nature itself. The laws of the Hebrew tradition, for example, are supposed to have been delivered by the same divine being who created the world, so they have the same source. And no one can ask himself, does this make sense? Is this the way people should behave? Is this a reasonable mode of conduct? One is to obey, obey, obey as given. Similarly, in the Orient, the laws of the society are regarded as part and parcel of the laws of the universe. Here, then, is the first point. There are four levels on which mythology is going to function. Now, the second and third, that is to say, the image of the cosmos and the order of society vary greatly from place to place and from time to time. This brings about a picture of great difference as one reviews the whole scene. On the other hand, this monstrous mystery that the consciousness has to be reconciled to has remained the same forever. And also the structure, the main nervous structure and organic structure of the human physique has been the same at least since the Origination Caves of 30,000 BC. So these constitute constants, whereas there is within the historical field great variation in the modes to which these constants are rendered. The old German medical man, who was one of the first and greatest in the survey of the whole field, Adolf Bastian, he called the universals, the constants that appear throughout mythology, the elementary ideas. And we can call them the elementary ideas, or the basic universals. And the different culture modes through which these ideas are inflected in terms of the needs and patterns of the different social orders, he called the ethnic ideas or the folk ideas. Now let me first say a word or two about certain basic divisions of the folk ideas. There are four great domains in the old world, the world from which our own traditions come, through which we see the universals manifesting themselves. If you divide the European Asian hemisphere at Iran, at Persia, the world will fall into two great departments. Eastward of Iran, eastward of Persia, there are two main creative culture zones. One is India, and the other is the Far East. If you look at a map, you will see that both of these are cut off from the rest of the world. India is surrounded on two sides by the sea, and the coasts are not endowed with great harbors and were very, very dangerous for small boats. And northward are the Himalaya Mountains. So that new influences have come into India and been assimilated very easily. There's been no massive impact on India until very modern times, with the modern Western industrial world walloping in. Likewise, China was cut off by the great deserts to the west. So these two zones, India and China, have been extremely conservative in their cultural character, and they have maintained to the very present in their traditional forms the basic style of religion of the old Bronze Age. Both of them were first settled in the style of the high civilizations in the period of the Bronze Age. India, the first datings for earliest India are now about 2500 BC, and the earliest datings for China about 1500 BC. China is the youngest, not, as is often claimed, the oldest of the old civilizations. So the main mode of mythological thought that was characteristic of the Bronze Age, before the coming of the Age of Iron, is what we find in China and Japan. China and India. Westward of Iran now, we again have two great creative culture zones. The first is the Levant, or the Near East. This is the zone where high civilization first originates. It is there that the arts of agriculture and animal husbandry were first developed about the 9th millennium BC. This is what made possible the establishment of settled communities and the growth of rather large communities. Where these large communities developed first was in Mesopotamia, and then Egypt, and then Crete. Mesopotamia, the earliest cities appear about 3500 BC. That's 1,000 years earlier than in India. And it is at that time, in that place, that the arts of mathematical reckoning, of writing, of calculating the movements of the planets mathematically and accurately first came into being. It was at that time that professional priests, whose whole lifetime was devoted to observing the heavens, recognized the movement of the planets through the constellations. They are the ones who first recognized the mathematical regularity of this process and conceived the notion of a cosmic order, a mathematically impersonal, inevitably moving cosmic order, to which the agricultural world had to submit. They watched the stars for the moments for planting and for reaping, and they also conceived the idea that that heavenly order should be repeated on earth, and the society itself became an imitation of the heavenly order. We still celebrate our religious festivals according to the astronomical calendar. The king, the queen, the members of the court assumed then the garments of the heavenly spheres. The king's, if the moon were the principal divinity, the king wore the horns of the moon. If the sun, he wore the golden radiant crown of the sun, and so forth and so on. This notion of, as it is in heaven, so shall it be on earth, is the basis for the forms, the culture forms, of the earliest civilizations of man. And these were carried to Egypt, to Crete, to China, and to India. The other great creative zone in the West is Europe. Now, Europe is the great homeland of the High Paleolithic, those glorious caves in France and Spain of Lascaux, Altamira, El Castillo, and so forth, date from, as I said a moment ago, 30,000 BC. There was nothing like them anywhere on earth for tens of thousands of years. And the whole ethos, the whole mode of life experience of the Paleolithic hunt is just right there in Europe, right up to very, very late times. Now, when you consider the nature of the hunt, how it depends upon the prowess and courage of the individual, how it matters greatly whether an individual can or cannot face the fight, you will see that on the base of a hunting culture style, individualism and the individual's powers are highly respected, whereas the opposite point of view prevails in a large community, particularly a community agriculturally based. Anybody can till a field. Individual talents are not greatly honored. And the individual is always subordinated to the will of and good of the group. Whereas in the hunting culture, the whole good and well-being of the community depends on the individual. You have just two totally contrary points of view here. Now, Europe and the Near East are very close together, and they are united furthermore by this wonderful Mediterranean. So there has been great commerce back and forth, and there has been great collision between these two totally contrary worldviews. Furthermore, we have not only these two, Levant and Europe, but we also have northern people and southern people coming in collision with each other. The European and Levantine fields have been fields of great cultural upheavals, great changes, great transformations. It was in this area, for example, that the art of riding the horse, of hitching horses to a very light war chariot was developed. This developed in the northern European plains about 1800 BC. And with this brilliant military arm, the northern peoples, the Indo-European or Aryan peoples, were invincible. And it was at that time that a whole new outgoing of a single order of life is to be recognized in the mythologies of the world. Against this, in the south, we have another nomadic warrior people, the great Semitic peoples of the Syro-Arabian desert. And they, just about the same time that the Aryans were appearing on the scene, about 2500 BC, they too were raiding in absolutely ruthless conquests. The Old Testament tells you the story. The book of Joshua and the book of Judges is a picture of the kind of sudden attack. It's a little peaceful town in a valley, and suddenly a cloud on the horizon, a dust cloud, and it happens to be a Bedouin swarm coming in, and the next morning everybody's dead in the streets. These collisions now of Levant and Europe and the northern warriors and the Semitic desert warriors have brought about, as I say, transformations that were not matched at all in the other parts of the world. Now, with respect to the metaphysical or basic religious attitudes of these domains. Eastward of Iran, both in India and in China, we have, as I say, the continuation of the old Bronze Age position. The notion is of an absolutely impersonal mathematical process of coming into being and going out of being, coming into being and going out of being, as the day, as the year, so also the eon. There never was a time when time was not. There never will be a time when time will cease to be. There is no personality responsible for this. It is a basically impersonal concept. And all of the deities who come into being with the world are simply the agents, the personifications of the powers that operate ruthlessly. Prayer can do no good. You cannot pray to a inevitably moving machine to stop. It's going to go on. With respect to what lies behind this, the force that lies behind it, no human concept can touch it. The Upanishads, the Indian Upanishads, say time and time again, their words do not reach. No concept, no image, no category of thought can touch that mystery. To ask, as we do in the West, personifying the whole mystery as God, to ask, is this just? Is it merciful? Is it wrathful? Does the God now like me? Does it like these people? Does it prefer those? this, from the standpoint of this position, is utter childishness. This is to project human sentiments, human categories, human emotions on something that is no thing, that actually is antecedent to all things, that is the energy and being that cannot be even called being, because being is already a category. Is it? Is it not? Those are categories of thought. And as the Buddha says, it both is and is not. It neither is nor is not. No categories can reach it. Now that which is thus transcendent, transcendent of all definition, it lies beyond picturing, lies beyond naming, to say, I know it, I have it in my book, its name is so-and-so, and it said this to so-and-so. This is, from this standpoint, sheer idolatry. It is to reduce to a concept, to a conceptualization, that which lies beyond all this. Nevertheless, that which lies beyond all this is your own very mystery and being. It is immanent. It is in anything we have here. The problem of the being of this glass is exactly the problem of the being of the universe. It's exactly the same mystery. The fact that you know how to use this, the fact that somebody may know how to make glass out of sand and heat and all this kind of thing, this does not take away from the fact that it's an utter mystery that this should be in existence. And what it is, who knows? So you can take anything, put a circle around it, and say, I don't know what it is. And with that, you open a dimension of awe that is the first experience of religion. Rudolf Otto, in his wonderful little book, The Idea of the Holy, names this experience of awe, of cosmic dread, the basic religious emotion. And from the standpoint of this Bronze Age, Oriental position, this is a perspective that can be opened through anything. Anything then becomes eligible for worship. I've seen a little child worshipped. I've seen a stick worshipped and a stone in this sense. Now when we move from that realm to the West, and to the Western religions, which are not Western religions in the full sense of the term, they are Levantine religions, the religions that have been brought into Europe from the Levant, we have a quite different point of view. The main religions in the Western world now are Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all of them from the Semitic field, all of them from the Levant. And in all of them, the ultimate mystery is personified as God. God, who is, and who has certain qualities that can be named and have been described. Just consider what we have to regard now. God creates the world. These are not the same. To say, as the Indians say, I in my own essence am that mystery. Tat tvam asi, thou art that, you are it. To say that on this side of the line is the final and basic heresy. These are two totally contrary worlds of religion. I would call the Eastern religions, religions intending identity. Religions of identity. The ultimate religious goal is to bring about in the individual the realization, not simply the thought, the realization that he is that. He is it. In his essence, in his being, he is that mystery. Not the he that he thinks he is, not the he that is named, not the he that came into being and goes out of being and his friends like him or his enemies don't like him and all those qualities, but that mystery about himself, which is like the mystery of the glass, to realize this as being of your essence is the goal of these religions. They are religions intending your own realization of identity. That's why the typical posture in the Orient is that of interned meditation. Whereas our religions of address, religions of relationship, and the typical posture is outward turned of relationship to something that is not of this world. Now this split, this division between the worlds of thought in which all the universe is divine, is a manifestation of that mystery, and the world in which this divinity is separated from the world, these are the two radically opposed religious views now competing in the world. I call the Levantine religions, religions of relationship. How is the relationship to the God achieved? It is achieved through one's identification with a certain social order. Our religions with terrific stress on the social group to which you belong. Consider, for example, the Hebrew religion as the starter here. This is the earliest of this triad. God, named, has a covenant with a certain people. That is a relationship. It is only through birth as a member of that race that one is in proper, direct, and authorized relationship to God. All others are out. This is an absolutely exclusive position, and it involves a group. Contrast with this, the Indian situation. In so long as you are in the world, great stress is placed on in society, great stress is placed on your obedience to the laws of society for your own good, in that you are eliminating your own ego emphasis. But finally, you quit the society, go into the forest, and are alone. Only in your own solitude can the ultimate be reached. Whereas in the Hebrew tradition, only in relation to the minyan can God be properly worshipped. 10 males of the Hebrew tradition are necessary. These I would call the extremes of the gamut of religion in the world. Take next the basic Christian idea, namely that Jesus is true God and true man. This we regard as surprising, as a miracle, as a special thing, whereas in the Orient everything is divine as well as secular. This unique, I believe in God the Father Almighty and all this, his only Son. Through our humanity, we are related to Jesus, and through his divinity, he relates us to God. And it is only through participation in the sacraments of his church, founded by him, that one extra ecclesiam nulla salus, no salvation outside the church. Here again, we have this exclusive position with great stress on the social group to which you belong, and the privilege, you might say, of that identification. So I would say, instead of religion of identification with the divinity, you have here a religion of achievement of a relationship to the divinity through identification with his group.